His father smiled. It was a small triumph to make him smile. Laughter in the evenings was beyond him. Ian thought the bad patches were a little further apart than they had been at first, but there were still times when it almost seemed as if gravity doubled its pull on his father. The skin of his face sagged. His big frame seemed weighed down. He looked exhausted. Was he ever going to get over it? And if he didn't, how could Ian leave him? The thought of it swamped him with guilt, and the guilt made him angry. You shouldn't have to feel guilty about living your own life. You shouldn't have to be responsible for your parents' happiness. It wasn't fair. The day was warming up, and the morning mist was lifting slowly off the surface of the water. He slid through it, the canoe making no more sound than the mist. It was a beautiful craft, and here he was, gliding along in it, stewing about something that was still more than a year away. He was fed up with himself, with the way he worried about everything. He drove himself crazy. He should be enjoying the canoe. It was a great birthday present, and the odds were that his father had bought it for him simply because he knew he would love it. Just that. No more, no less. In the wake of the mist, a light breeze was stirring, and the clean, acid smell of the trees drifted across the water. He dipped into Blake's Bay, but there was no sign of Pete. So he carried on to Hopeless Inlet, and found him anchored in the marshy bit, where the pike liked to hide, hunched over his fishing line like an old troll.
"Well, well, a white man in a canoe," Pete said as he came up. "What do you know?"
"Not bad, is it?" Ian said.
"I'll tell you something," Pete said, stretching out one leg, then folding it up again and stretching the other. The thwarts in the Queen Mary were very low, and Pete's legs were very long, so his knees were always jackknifed up around his ears. The knees of his jeans had given up the struggle long ago and were split straight across from seam to seam.
"When you guys have evolved a bit more, like in a billion years or so, you'll discover the outboard motor, and you'll never look back."
Ian grinned, but lately there seemed to be an edge to Pete's jokes, and sometimes it made him uneasy.
"It's a nice canoe, though," he said, trying again. "You have to admit."
"It's nice," Pete said, "but I'd like to see you land a pike in it. Man overboard!"
At that precise moment his hook was grabbed by something so big that Pete was flung to the side of the Queen Mary. The jigger flew out of his hands, and he came within half an inch of going overboard himself.
"Holy shit," he said, when he'd recovered himself. "What was that?"
Ian was laughing too hard to answer. Pete took an oar from the bottom of his boat, paddled the Queen Mary up beside the canoe, reached out, and before Ian could stop him, gave the side of the canoe a little push, and over it went. The water was so cold, Ian's heart almost stopped. He came to the surface, gasping with the shock of it, and there was Pete looking down at him and grinning like a cat.
"You've christened it," Pete said. "It's good luck to dunk your canoe first time out. You're going to be a lucky man."
And he was right, because Ian heaved himself out of the water, made a wild grab at Pete's arm, and by sheerest luck managed to catch it, flung himself backward, and Pete ended up in the water too. It was just like old times. At church, Ian and his father sat in their usual pew. It was a full house. The summer-like weather had cheered everyone up and made them more willing to sit through a sermon in return for the pleasure of gathering around the church steps afterward and getting caught up on the gossip. The women were wearing summer dresses and hats with fake flowers. Everybody looked brighter and more alive than they had a month ago, when there was still snow on the ground. Even the children seemed less fractious than usual. Reverend Thomas was the only one out of step. His sermon was on the theme of pain, on accepting that life was full of it, on enduring it cheerfully, on welcoming the closeness to God that suffering could bring. Ian, who was wider awake than usual because of his early morning dip, heard his father suppress a snort. He'd seen more of pain than Reverend Thomas had.
Arthur and Laura Dunn and the children sat three rows ahead, as they always did. Ian fixed his eyes on Laura, as he'd been doing now for what felt like his whole life. If Kathy had been there, he might have felt guilty, but her family went to the Baptist church at the other end of town. Ian was secretly glad. It left him free to concentrate on Laura. He still felt the usual confusion of emotions when he was in her presence. It was like a drink of cool water in the desert, and being eaten alive by army ants, both at the same time. After church, while Arthur headed back to his truck so that he wouldn't have to talk to anyone, she came up to speak to him. "Happy birthday," she said. Carter had followed his father, but Julie and March came with their mother. Julie smiled shyly up at Ian. She was shy with him again because she had seen so little of him during the winter. March, the baby, who wasn't a baby anymore, stopped digging a trench in the sand around his mother's feet with the toe of his shoe and looked up at Ian curiously. Laura said to them, "Aren't you going to wish Ian a happy birthday?"
"Happy birthday," Julie said.
"Thank you," said Ian. March said,
"I got a truck."
"Do you?" Ian said. "Where is it?"
"At home," Laura said, "or he'd have been running up and down the aisle with it."
"What color is it?"
Ian asked March. He must be almost three by now. In the past 2 years, he seemed to have improved considerably. So had Julie. Ian didn't mind either of them now.
"Blue,"
March said uncertainly, looking up at his mother for confirmation. She nodded.
"Like your dad's," Ian said, and March looked over to where his father's truck was parked under a tree.
He shook his head.
"It's smaller," he said regretfully.
"Maybe it'll grow," Ian said, and March frowned at him under his thatch of fair hair.
"Ian's teasing you," said Laura.
She touched the side of March's cheek with the back of her hand, making Ian ache with longing. He watched her make her way slowly back to the truck, Julie and March trailing along behind her like small dinghies behind the mothership. Carter and Arthur were standing by the truck. Carter was asking his father something. Arthur shook his head, and Carter turned away, his shoulders hunched. Typical Carter posture. But he wasn't really a bad kid, Ian thought. He didn't sass his parents or refuse to do what he was told or throw rocks through people's windows. It was just that he always seemed so moody. Ian would see him in the school playground at lunchtime and during recess, watching while the other boys in his class kicked a football around. He wasn't good at sports, not team sports anyway. The only thing he was really good at, as far as Ian knew, was running. During sports day at the end of the year, he usually won every race he was entered for. He'd come flying in, face flaming with exhilaration, 20 yards ahead of the rest. Maybe speed was his thing. He was fast on a bike, too. Sometimes in the evenings, Ian would see him streaking down the road, crouched over the handlebars, head down, a long, low cloud of dust trailing out behind him. At home, though, he was one big negative. Sullen and uncommunicative. It was possible, Ian thought, that Arthur had been like that as a kid, but it seemed unlikely. His silence now was companionable rather than morose. The same with Pete. He wouldn't describe Pete as gabby, but his silence was thoughtful. Carter's silence was resentful. Maybe he'd grow out of it. Ian found it hard to believe that Carter was only 4 years younger than he. He seemed such a kid. Strange, he thought later, how sometimes when you start thinking about a person, you seem to bring them to the foreground of your life. At 11 o'clock that night, there was a hammering on the door, and when Ian answered it, Sergeant Moynihan was standing on the porch, gripping a boy firmly by the arm. The boy was Carter. He was bleeding from a cut on his forehead, and his face was white and scared.
"Took his father's truck," the policeman said without preamble, propelling Carter into the hall. "Went for a little spin on his own. Left the road, clipped a rock, ended up in the ditch. Lucky he didn't hit a tree. Where's your dad?"
"He's been called out," Ian said, ushering them toward his father's office. "He shouldn't be too long."
"Stick a bandage on him or something," said Sergeant Moynihan. "I'll phone his parents."
He prodded Carter's shoulder with his forefinger.
"What's your phone number?"
Carter mumbled the number. He was holding a bloody handkerchief to his head and looked unsteady on his feet. The policeman headed toward the hall. Over his shoulder, he said to Ian,
"You're getting lots of practice nowadays, I hear. Stitch him up yourself, why don't you? Save your dad the trouble."
"No, thanks," Ian said sourly. He led Carter into his father's office and sat him down in a chair. He still looked very white, and Ian wondered if he was going to keel over. He kept a hand on Carter's shoulder for a minute or two, until the boy seemed steadier. Then he went over to the medicine cabinet and got a pad of surgical dressing out of the drawer.
"I'm just going to put a dressing on it," he said. "It'll do until my dad gets back."
He carefully removed the bloody handkerchief and applied the dressing. Carter flinched, but didn't protest.
"Hold it there," Ian said. "I'll put a bandage around it to keep it in place. It's not too bad. It's almost stopped bleeding."
They could hear Sergeant Moynihan on the phone out in the hall.
"I'll find out," they heard him say, and he came into the office. "Your mother's worried, of course," he said to Carter. "And they can't come and get you, can they, because you swiped the truck?"
He turned to Ian.
"She wants to know how bad it is. Is he going to have to go to the hospital?"
"Probably not," Ian said.
He was winding the bandage firmly around Carter's head.
"My dad'll want to make sure he doesn't have a concussion, though, and it'll need a couple of stitches. Tell her we'll bring him home."
Sergeant Moynihan nodded and went back to the phone.
"I can walk home," Carter said, his voice shaky. "I guarantee my dad'll veto that."
Ian fastened the end of the bandage to the rest with a safety pin. He was dying to know what the story was. Sergeant Moynihan came back into the room.
"Okay," he said. "I'm going to go and help his dad get the truck back on the road."
He turned to Carter.
"What was it all about, then? You're way underage, aren't you?"
He waited a minute, then prodded Carter's shoulder.
"How old are you?"
Still no reply. He prodded him again.
"Come on, how old?"
"Nearly 14,
Carter said, coming to life all at once, angrily leaning away from the prodding finger. He didn't seem intimidated, though. Ian was impressed, in spite of himself.
13, in other words, 3 years away from old enough. You could have killed somebody, killed yourself. Not very smart, was it?"
Carter didn't reply. Sergeant Moynihan sighed.
"Kids," he said.
He hoisted his pants. He had a sizable paunch, and his trousers fought a losing battle to stay on top of it.
"Okay, I'm off. I expect his dad could come and get him when we get the truck out, if it's still drivable. Didn't look like too much damage."
To Carter, he said, "You'll be lucky if it doesn't take it out of your hide." He left, and they heard the police car pull away. Ian sat down in his father's chair and studied Carter. Carter was looking at the floor.
"So, did you just want to go for a drive?" Ian said.
He remembered nagging his father to take him driving out along the lake road, where you didn't see another car for hours. He couldn't have been more than 14 at the time.
"Yeah."
"Why didn't you ask your dad? He'd have taken you, wouldn't he?" Most of the farm kids he knew were driving their father's tractors by the time they were Carter's age, but of course the Dunns didn't have a tractor. Carter looked up. Under the bandage, his face was still very pale, but his eyes were hot and angry. There were streaks of drying blood smeared down to his chin. If it had been anyone else, Ian would have cleaned them off, but he suspected Carter wouldn't appreciate it.
"I did ask him."
"What did he say?"
"Same as always. Not now. Everything's not now. He won't let me do anything."
"What do you mean?" Ian asked, intrigued.
"Like what?"
Carter shrugged and looked away, his mouth set in a bitter line. For a moment, Ian felt sorry for him. It was true Arthur didn't seem to pay much attention to him. Even the chores he was given to do kept him close to the house, under his mother's supervision.
"How about your mother? Wouldn't she teach you to drive?"
"She's too busy," Carter said, his tone flat.
"Well, sometime when she isn't."
He imagined Laura in the passenger seat of the battered old truck, calmly and patiently instructing her son. Well, possibly not calmly. He thought of the harried way she rushed around. He wouldn't exactly describe her as calm. And now that he thought about it, she wasn't always all that patient with her kids, especially Carter. But she was still a wonderful mother. Carter had no idea how lucky he was. "She's always too busy," Carter said, the bitter tone still there. "She's permanently busy." "You probably just got her at a bad time," Ian said. "You should ask her again." Carter's head came up. "What do you know about it?" he said, nastily. "You don't live there. She isn't your mother." Which made Ian want to take him out behind the house and beat him to a pulp. He went out to the farm the following night. It was late, almost 10 o'clock, and he was afraid the Duns would have gone to bed. But he was in luck, and the kitchen light was still on. Arthur was the only one in there, sitting in his usual chair. He and Laura always went upstairs together, so Ian guessed Laura was helping her father get ready for bed. The old man slept in a small room off the parlor so that he didn't have to negotiate the stairs. Ian stood under the trees at the edge of the farmyard, out of range of the blocks of light cast by the windows. Upstairs, the light was on in Carter's room. The truck was parked over by the barn. Ian went over and had a look at it. As far as he could tell in the darkness, it didn't look any worse than it always had. He went back to his vantage point and waited for Laura to appear. The night air was still cold. It was only May, after all. He hunched his shoulders and stuffed his hands in his pockets. It was a relief to have the snow gone so he didn't have to worry about leaving footprints. For 5 or 6 months of the year, it was really too dangerous to come. Now all he had to beware of was Arthur, who sometimes came out to take a leak against a tree rather than go upstairs to the bathroom. Or Carter. The idea of Carter discovering him made Ian's hair stand on end. He knew what everyone would think if he were caught. There would be scandal. He'd be called a peeping Tom, a pervert. But that wasn't so. Sure, he fantasized about Laura, but he had never seen her naked, and it was only when she had been breastfeeding March that he'd seen her breasts. If that had been the purpose of his visits, he would have given up long ago. But that wasn't why he came. He wasn't sure exactly why he did come, but it wasn't for that. It reassured him to know that she was there, that was all. He came to check that everything was as it should be. One of the dogs nuzzled his legs, and he reached down to pat it. When he looked up, Laura was coming into the kitchen. She paused in the doorway and pushed her hair back off her face in a gesture of fatigue, and Arthur, who had looked up when she appeared, stood up, quite quickly for him, crossed the kitchen, put his arms around her and drew her close. Laura rested her head against his chest, her eyes closed. She rubbed his back very gently with her hands. Ian watched, electrified. After a moment or two, they separated and began turning off the lights in preparation for going up to bed. But Ian stood on, long after the darkness had closed in around him, holding their image in his mind. Chapter 6. Cow killed on North Road. Canada extends heartiest of welcomes to their most gracious majesties. Temiscaming Speaker, April-May, 1939. How long would it take to atone? Arthur, watching the repercussions of Jake's accident rippling out across their lives, saw that it was going to take forever. Jake was in the hospital for 3 months. At first, until he was well enough to be moved, he was in the hospital in New Liscard, and then they transferred him to Sudbury, farther south. The transfer was done in a proper ambulance rather than the hearse, and that, plus the hospital fees, plus the 4 operations it took to put Jake's bones back in the right places, plus his mother's few trips to Sudbury to visit her child, cost money they didn't have. Arthur's father, who in the months since the accident had developed deep grooves down the sides of his face, had to borrow the money from the bank. Debt. They were in debt. The very word made Arthur's guts churn with anxiety. Until that time, he hadn't given money much thought. They'd never had much, but neither had anyone else they knew. Money was something people in the towns and cities had. Mr. Taggart, the bank manager in Struan, or Mr. Fitzpatrick, who owned the sawmill, they had money. Most of the farmers in the area wouldn't see more than $20 from one year to the next, but they didn't consider themselves poor. With the exception of salt and sugar and tea, they grew just about everything they ate, and for the other things they needed, tools, nails, shoes, gas for the truck, the odd bit of farm machinery, when the bits they had were past mending, if you didn't have the money, you paid in kind. Even the doctor and the vet were happy if you paid them in chickens or ham or a bushel of corn. But everyone knew about debt nowadays. Even if you couldn't count to 10, you knew about debt. The men, hobos, wandering up the dusty road to Struan looking for work had brought with them tales of horror from all over the country. Terrible droughts on the big farms out in the prairies, people starving in alleyways in the cities, even kids being sold by their parents in the hope that their new owner would feed them well and not work them to death. Hair-raising stories that made you grateful that Struan was where it was, though even here things were hard. Alongside debt were other words that had come to have a frightening reality here in the North as well as everywhere else. Destitution, for instance. Starvation. The small farms around Struan had been lucky compared to many. The drought hadn't hit them so hard, and the fields were small and surrounded by woods, so that even in severe dry spells the wind couldn't blow the topsoil away. They weren't totally isolated from what was happening in the world outside, of course. The price of wheat affected them, and the demand for milk. But most of the farms, including the Duns, were mixed and on a small scale. If they couldn't sell one thing, they could sell another. And if they couldn't sell anything at all, they could eat it and sit tight and wait for better times. But the hospital wouldn't accept a cow in payment. The hospital wanted money, a lot of money. Arthur heard a sound downstairs one night about 3 a.m. He got out of bed and crept along to the top of the stairs and saw his father lower himself into the chair by the stove as if he were an old man, and then just sit there staring at nothing. One evening, he went back to the bridge. He'd been trying to comfort himself with the thought that he couldn't have saved Jake anyway, but he needed to know that for sure. Standing on the bridge, looking down at the surging water, he had a brief moment of hope, because although he'd got to Jake pretty damned fast after he fell, he could see that he would not have been able to get there in time to catch him, even if such a thing were possible. But there might have been another way, a much simpler way. He left the bridge and walked along the bank, studying the structure of it from the side, and felt his innards clench within him. He went back and walked out to the middle of it, where he and the cow had stood, and lay down on his stomach and hung his head over the side and reached under, groping for the pole Jake had been hanging from. He felt his fingers touch it, the cold, slippery smoothness of it. He could have reached Jake's hand if he had tried. He could have pulled him to safety. But he hadn't tried. He had done nothing. He had said, "Good." That word. He tried to tell himself Jake wouldn't have been able to hear it over the rush of the water. He clung to that hope. Had he known that this time Jake wasn't crying wolf? Sometimes he thought he must have, deep down. Jake had been annoying him so much that day, maybe he had even willed him to fall, maybe just for a moment, at the very heart of him, he had wanted Jake dead. He wished someone would punish him, send him to jail or something, though he knew there could be no worse punishment than watching what his parents were going through. He wanted to confess, but couldn't bring himself to do it. He should have confessed at the time. He remembered his mother bending over Jake's twisted body, crying, "What happened? Oh, what happened?" Remembered himself telling her Jake had slipped. He should have told her the truth then and there. He should have said, "I could have saved him, Mum. But I didn't believe him." He should have done it then, because it was getting harder to do with every passing day. And worse, much worse, one day soon, Jake was going to tell their mother himself, and she would tell their father, and then they would truly despise him. After each of his mother's trips to Sudbury, Arthur searched her face to see if she knew. But each time, her look was as it always was. What was Jake waiting for? Why didn't he tell her? There were times when Arthur wished he would. And then about 2 months after the accident, he and his father were out in the bush one afternoon cutting poplar saplings for fencing, and suddenly, out of the blue, his father said, "How did he fall?" They hadn't been discussing Jake. They hadn't been talking at all. It was hot and still, the sky heavy with a threat of rain, and the flies and mosquitoes were driving them crazy. They were just trying to get the job done fast so they could get out of the woods. Arthur straightened up and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. He should have been glad that now he could get it over with at last, but his insides had turned to jelly. "He slipped," he said at last. That lie again. He didn't look at his father. To lose his good opinion, suddenly that seemed unendurable, worse than living with the guilt. "There's a handrail," his father said, not looking at him either. He leaned on the willowy stem of a poplar with one hand, bending it over, ready for the blow. "Yeah, but he slipped under it."
"Slipped under the rail? That what you're telling me?"
"Yeah."
"He was fooling around,"
Arthur's father said, splitting the trunk of the poplar with one savage blow.
"Just like I thought. Fooling around, like always."
"Yeah, but," Arthur said. This was a possibility he hadn't thought of, that his father would lay the blame on Jake.
"But nothing," his father said, fury in his voice. "But nothing. Fooling around, always fooling around. And now look what's happened."
He picked up the fallen poplar, furiously hacked off the crown, and tossed it onto the pile of other poles.
"How are we going to pay it off, eh? You tell me. You know what happens if we can't pay it off? You know what happens? The bank takes the farm. That's what happens."
Arthur's heart was pounding. He felt words like pebbles rolling around in his mouth, so many he was almost choking on them, all of them wanting to come out at once. "It was my fault, Dad. I let him fall. I could have saved him. I could have reached him, but I didn't. I thought he was crying wolf again, but I think I knew he wasn't. I think I knew. You know what I said when he told me he was slipping? I said, 'Good, Dad. I said, good.'" He tried to say it, got as far as opening his mouth, but his father rounded on him, pointed at him with the head of the axe.
"Don't you damn well make excuses for him. Don't you damn well do that ever again, you and your mother."
He shook the axe at Arthur. He was so mad, spittle was flying from his mouth.
14 damn years old, never taken responsibility for a single damn thing he's ever done. A baby's what he is, a big, useless nuisance of a baby. And now look."
The still air echoed with his rage. All summer long, while the sun beat down on the ripening crops, turning them from green to dusty gold, Arthur worked off his guilt in the fields. Sun up to sun down, he was out there. There was comfort in the labor, but no absolution. Jake came home at the end of July. An ambulance brought him all the way from Sudbury. More debt. Though when you looked at him, it seemed disgraceful to think about money. He was in plaster from head to toe. Both of his legs were in casts from his feet to his hips, and another cast encased him from his hips to his armpits. His face, which was practically all of him that you could see, was so thin, the bones seemed about to split the skin. The ambulance men carried him into the kitchen on a stretcher and put him on the bed Arthur's mother had made up for him there. When they had gone, and when Arthur's mother, practically torn asunder by the mixture of anxiety and joy, had gone upstairs to get some further item for Jake's comfort, and when his father, who hadn't said a single word since the ambulance arrived, had gone outside again,
Arthur went up to Jake's bed. His mouth was so dry he could hardly speak.
"How you doing?" he managed finally.
"Okay," Jake said.
The two of them looked at each other. Arthur was no more capable of reading his brother's expression than he had ever been, but he knew he had to say what needed saying right now before another moment passed. He licked his lips.
"About what happened," he said.
Jake watched him.
"I'm sorry," Arthur tried to say, but his voice cracked. He swallowed and tried again. "I'm sorry about it."
It sounded so stupid, he almost expected Jake to laugh. You cripple your brother for life and all you can say is sorry? But if there were other words, he didn't know what they were. Jake turned his head away for a minute, gazing at the door their father had gone out of. He looked about 6 years old, lying there, and at the same time about 60. After a minute, he looked back and said,
"Did you mean what you said, Art? When we were on the bridge? Did you want me to fall?"
The breath came out of Arthur in a rush, as if he'd been hit in the stomach. He'd been prepared for shouts of accusation or savagely whispered threats of revenge or for Jake to say he'd hate him for the rest of his life, but not this direct, simple, unbearable question. When he was finally able to speak, all he could say was, "Jesus, no, Jake. Oh, Jesus, no." The words coming out between a croak and a sob. Jake studied him for a while, then he said, "How's Dad?"
"What?"
Arthur said, wiping his nose with the back of his hand. He could hear their mother walking around upstairs. If she overheard them, it would kill her.
"Was Dad very upset?"
"Jesus, Jake, what are you talking about?" Jake looked at him steadily. "Was he upset?"
"Jesus," Arthur said in agony all over again. "Of course he was."
It was the simplicity of the questions he couldn't bear, and the knowledge that Jake must have been lying on a hospital bed, unable to move, asking himself those questions for 3 whole months.
"He didn't come and see me," Jake said. "Not once."
"Mom wanted to," Arthur said in anguish. "It cost a lot of money for someone to go. They couldn't both go." Jake looked away. Finally, without looking back, he said, "Anyway, I guess it doesn't matter." He seemed about to say something else, but they heard their mother's footsteps on the stairs. How'd you go about making amends for something like that? A lifetime wouldn't be long enough. That summer, it seemed to Arthur that his life had changed forever. It was inconceivable that things could ever return to how they had been before. And yet they did. Labor Day came, the end of the summer holidays, and his mother made him go back to school. It was incredible. There he was, 19 years old and the size of a truck, every last vestige of a childhood wrung out of him by 5 months of anguish, sitting at a desk like a little kid back in grade 11 for the second time. His friends, when he saw them, Carl, Ted, and the others, couldn't believe it either. They didn't exactly say so, but Arthur knew they found the idea downright embarrassing. None of them was the type to give unasked-for advice, but Carl said once in an undertone, speaking out of the side of his mouth and looking off into the woods,
"Why don't you just stop going, Art? She can't make you. You're bigger than she is."
Arthur thought about it, imagined himself standing in the kitchen saying, "I ain't going, Mum. That's all there is to it. I just ain't going." But he could never get the picture to come clear. He had never defied her, and guessed he never would. The ridiculous thing was that Jake, who was longing to get back to school, was nowhere near strong enough, and was probably going to miss a whole year. At the end of August, Dr. Christofferson had come out to the farm and cut the casts off him, and helped him to his feet, and supported him while he took his first steps, and then broke it to them, that although Jake was healing well, one leg was now shorter than the other, and he was going to have a limp for the rest of his life. Arthur took the news a lot harder than Jake did. Jake looked as if he thought a limp might be kind of interesting.
Arthur, on the other hand, knew that if they both lived to be 100 years old, every time he looked at Jake, he was going to see that limp. But still, he almost forgot about it with the agony of being back at school. The first few days went by in a haze of disbelief. He sat at his desk like a sack of cement, hearing and seeing nothing. Then, on the Monday morning of the second week, they were herded off to the gym for assembly, all the classes jammed in together, and Mr. Wheeler, the principal, came in and got up on the little stage at the end of the room and said he had an important, no, a momentous announcement to make. Arthur stopped listening. The gym had high windows that you couldn't look out of, like a prison, so he looked at his feet instead and thought that he would rather be dead than be here. After a minute or two, though, he became aware of a stir in the room. Kids were looking at each other. Some of them were grinning and looking excited. And then he caught a word or two of what Mr. Wheeler was saying. Duty was one of the words, and patriotism was another. And it turned out that his momentous announcement actually was quite momentous. Canada was at war. There had been rumors for quite a while about a war coming. In fact, there had been something about England being at war with Germany in the Temiscaming speaker the previous week. But it hadn't meant much to Arthur, and wouldn't have even if he hadn't been preoccupied by guilt. There was a joke that the only news that mattered in the North was the weather, but he couldn't see what was supposed to be funny about it. It was true. His father would say the same. His mother was the only one in the family who was interested in what was going on in the world outside. She read the paper and would have liked a wireless, too. The speaker came out only once a week, so the news was always out of date by the time they got it. But when Arthur and his father got in from the fields in the evening, they were so tired they wouldn't have cared if half the world had been wiped off the map. But now it seemed the world had come to Struan. Mr. Wheeler, standing on the rickety little stage at the front of the gym, was reading to them from the speech that the Prime Minister himself, Mr. Mackenzie King, had broadcast to the nation. "The forces of evil have been loosed in the world," Mr. Wheeler read. He looked out at his audience, a gym full of schoolchildren, graded by age and size, the younger sitting on the floor at the front, the older one standing at the back. His face was grave. "The forces of evil," he repeated. Maybe he liked the sound of it because he repeated it again, in capitals this time. "The forces of evil," he let the words echo around the gym. "And every able-bodied man." He dropped his voice and looked slowly around the room, not reading any more, making his own speech now. "Every able-bodied man will be anxious to go to the defense of our mother country. Those of you who are not old enough as yet should not despair." He looked gravely at the younger children seated on the floor at his feet. "Your turn will come." He lifted his head and smiled at the older boys. "Those of you who are old enough will be proud, I know, to serve your country, and will do so valiantly." School was dismissed for the day. Arthur started to walk home, but then changed his mind and went back into Struan. He guessed that when the other guys heard the news, they'd probably come into town. It was full of people already. Arthur had never seen so many people all together before. They were gathered in little clutches around the front of the post office and on the steps of the bank. The older ones mostly looked worried and serious, the younger ones excited. Half a dozen boys were laughing and shrieking and pushing each other off the steps of the drugstore. While Arthur watched, Mr. Phillips, the druggist, came out and told them it was no day for behavior like that. Arthur hung around on the outskirts of a group of men by the post office. They were saying that it would all be over in a matter of weeks, that this Hitler guy was full of gas. Arthur listened to them, head down, but keeping an eye out for Carl or one of the others. Finally, he saw Carl and Ted coming down the road and went to meet them. "Hi," Ted called. "You heard, eh?"
"Yeah."
"What do you think?" Carl said. "You going to join up?"
"Yeah," Arthur said again.
He saw that it was the answer to everything. He'd sign up
and go to the war, and even if it lasted only a couple of weeks, his mother would never be able to send him back to school. No one, not even his mother, could send someone who had been in uniform back to school. He would fight for his country. That would be a good thing to do, something he could set against the terrible events of the summer. He didn't discuss it with his parents. They had heard the news by the time he got home. But if the idea of him joining up had crossed their minds, they didn't say so. He guessed they'd be hoping it wouldn't occur to him. His mother would try to stop him going, and his father might too. His father didn't approve of war. He'd been in the last one, and it had put him off wars for good. Arthur felt bad about deceiving them, but he didn't know what else to do. He met up with Carl and Ted and a couple of others that evening after supper. Carl had heard there were enlistment teams traveling around the North signing people up, but they decided they wouldn't wait for that. What if the teams had never heard of Struan? It wasn't very big, and might not even be on the map. It would be safer to go down to North Bay. That was where most men were going. They agreed to give it a couple of days, just in case the speaker had got it wrong and there wasn't a war after all, but by the following day it was clear that it really was happening. The next morning, the whole bunch of them—Arthur and Ted and Jude Libovitz and Carl and Carl's two older brothers and a couple of guys from the sawmill and two Indian guys from the reserve—set out together. Arthur left home at the usual time, as if he were going to school. It made him sweat to think what his parents would say when they found out, but by then it would be done. Once he had enlisted, that was that. He'd been so busy worrying about his parents' reaction that it wasn't until he was in the back of the truck—they had borrowed Carl's father's old flatbed—that he started to think about what it was going to mean for his father in practical terms. Then he felt so bad he almost jumped out. How could he walk off and leave his father to manage the farm on his own, with debts up to his ears? But then he reasoned that there were still men roaming the country, looking for work. And though his father couldn't afford to pay them, many of them were so desperate that they were prepared to work for 3 square meals and a bed in the barn. And anyway, the war would be over in a few weeks, and then he'd be free to work with his father all day and every day for the rest of his life, so it was going to work out for the best all around. They had a good day for the trip, warm and sunny. They'd all thrown their coats on the floor of the truck, and they sat on them, and watched the trees and the rocks and the fields go by. They got to New Liskeard and then headed south through Temagami. Already Arthur was farther from home than he'd ever been in his life. Carl had brought a big bag of apples, and they sat there munching on them, talking about what was to come. They decided they were all going to join the army. Ted said he didn't like the sound of the Navy. What happened if your ship went down? And as for the Air Force, forget it. None of them had any faith in those parachute things. They all had done a fair bit of hunting, and they'd seen the way birds came hurtling to the ground when they'd been shot. "And they're mostly feathers," Carl said. "They don't weigh nothing. Think how fast we'd fall, man. We'd make such a hole in the ground they wouldn't have to dig us a grave." They talked a bit about the war, but nobody had much idea what it was about. There was this German guy, Hitler, and he was trying to take over the world. That was all they knew. There was an awkward spell then, because they all suddenly remembered that the Luntz brothers' parents were German. But then Gunter, who was the eldest, must have realized what the silence was about, because he suddenly got mad and said they were as Canadian as anyone else in the truck, as Canadian as anyone else in the whole damned country. They'd been born here, and their parents had given them their blessing to go off to fight for Canada. Not England, mind you. They weren't fighting for England, but for Canada, and had told them to take the truck to go and join up. And what more proof did anybody want? Which made them all feel ashamed. After that, they were quiet for a bit. The countryside was still pretty wild. Arthur wondered what Germany would look like, or wherever they ended up. Not as beautiful as Canada, that was a safe bet. He got a kind of ache mid-chest at the thought. Homesick already, and he was only 50 miles from home. And then, suddenly, they were in North Bay. It was a big town, way bigger than Struan, Buildings everywhere, the roads jammed with cars and trucks and army vehicles. The whole place was swarming with men and boys, hundreds of them, it seemed to Arthur, and all of them wanting to sign up. Some seemed to be straight out of the woods, tough-looking guys with beards down to their bellies and clothes that looked like they'd been through a couple of wars already. They would be trappers or hunters or lumberjacks. Most of them carried rifles as if they thought the army would expect you to bring your own. It was a mystery to Arthur how they could have heard the news so fast, but there they were. He thought he wouldn't mind being drafted into the same outfit as some of them and the Indian guys. They looked as if they could take care of themselves all right, and you could bet they were pretty damn good shots. It wasn't until he had this thought that it came home to him that war was about killing people. He might even get killed himself. The idea struck him as funny. Just a couple of days ago, he'd been standing in the school gymnasium, thinking that he'd rather be dead than be there, and now it looked as if maybe God was going to take him up on it. He didn't believe it, though. Couldn't imagine himself dead. Also couldn't imagine killing anyone, couldn't imagine aiming a gun at someone, far less pulling the trigger. But maybe you could just fire to one side of them and hope they'd do the same for you. They had parked the truck by this time and joined the lineup of men, and all the time Arthur was thinking these things, they were being herded around like cattle, people asking them questions and filling in forms. Eventually, Arthur found himself standing in a big tent, stark naked, being examined by an old guy in uniform who turned out to be a doctor. The doctor asked him more questions, about illnesses he might have had and such things, most of which Arthur didn't know the answer to, and what with that and the embarrassment of standing there in the buff, he couldn't concentrate on what the doctor was saying, and it took him a while to realize that he was being rejected. "Why?" he said, bewildered, when it finally sank in. "What's wrong with me?" "Flat feet," the doctor said, scribbling on a form. "Flat as pancakes. Never seen a flatter pair of feet in my life." He looked up at Arthur. "You know, they say an army marches on its stomach. It's a lie, son. An army marches on its feet, and those feet wouldn't be up to the job." He leaned back in his chair and guffawed as if he'd cracked a really good joke, and then started scribbling again. Arthur looked down, flattening his privates with one hand so they wouldn't obscure the view. His feet looked flat all right, but so what? They worked. All the thousands of miles he had trudged across the fields of home, lugging sacks of potatoes, bales of hay, bushels of wheat, and the army thought he wouldn't be able to carry a rifle and a little knapsack across some field in Europe. "They don't hurt," he said to the doctor. "They've never hurt at all, except once when my brother threw a knife into one of them." "Go home, son," the doctor said, without looking up at him. "Next, please." They gave him a little button to wear in his lapel to show that he was medically unfit and not a coward. But no one would know what it meant. People didn't come up to you to read what was written on a button before making up their minds about you. His mother forgave him. When she knew he had been rejected, her relief was so great that she forgave him for trying to sign up. His father sat there shaking his head. Arthur saw that his hands were trembling, but he was past caring. Jake was at the table, too. He was up and about now, hobbling around the kitchen. Arthur reckoned he must think being turned down because of flat feet was pretty funny, considering his own injuries, but at least he wasn't smirking. He was just listening, saying nothing. "You tried, Arthur," his mother said soothingly, her voice full of sympathy, now that he was safely home. "You tried your best to serve your country. No one can do more." Her voice grated on him. It made him want to shout at her, which he had never done. He kept his head down and shoveled in his dinner. Flat feet. He felt sick with humiliation and disappointment. All of his friends were going, of course. It was a repeat of when he was 16 and they had all left school, except him. He was like some poor, bloody bullock with its head permanently stuck in a fence, watching the rest of the herd amble off to greener pastures.
"You tried," his mother said again. "No one can help having flat feet, Arthur. There's nothing you can do."
"Sure there is," his father said. He seemed to have recovered from his shock, and there was something in his voice, a winding up, a digging in, like a man girding his loins for battle, that made Arthur pause with his fork halfway to his mouth.
"What do you mean, Henry? They've turned him down."
"All those boys," his father said, "all those boys, Otto Luntz, all three boys gone, how's he going to run that farm? Jim Collins, both his boys gone, Frank Libovitz, same. They're going to need men to work in the fields. Country's got to eat. The army's got to eat."
"What are you saying, Henry? Arthur tried to go. He offered, and they turned him down. They can't ask more of him than that. He's free to carry on with his education."
Arthur's father put down his fork and wiped his hands on his shirt a couple of times, then looked straight down the table at his wife. "Arthur's not sitting in school when other boys are off fighting for their country. That's what I'm saying. If he can't fight, he has to farm."
His mother said, "Henry, there's no—"
But his father raised his hand and cut her off. "That's the end of it," he said. "I'm telling you, Mary, that's the end of it." He picked up his fork and went on with his dinner. And that was the end of it. Freedom. 19 years old, flat-footed, and riddled with guilt, but free at last.
Chapter 7. Speckled trout season starts on Saturday. Compare three ways of pasturing cows. Temiscaming Speaker, April-May, 1960. When he was younger, Ian had assumed that as you got older, things became clear. Adults had seemed so sure, so knowledgeable, not just about facts and figures, but about the big questions, the difference between right and wrong, what was true and what wasn't, what life was about. He'd assumed that you went to school because you had to learn things, starting off with the easy stuff and moving on to the bigger issues. And once you'd learned them, that was it. The way ahead opened up, and thereafter life was simple and straightforward. What a joke. The older he got, the more complicated and obscure everything became. He understood nothing anymore, nothing and nobody, including himself. Kathy broke up with him in April. She said their relationship wasn't going anywhere. He hadn't realized it was supposed to. Where did she want it to go? When he asked her that, she burst into tears. Now she avoided him, turned her back on him, walked off if he tried to talk to her. He felt bad about it. He still liked her, and would have preferred to remain friends. And then there was the equally complicated business of what he was going to do with his life in terms of a career. A couple of months ago, Mr. Hardy, the history teacher, had asked him to stay behind after school for a little talk. There were 9 of them taking grade 13, 6 boys and 3 girls, and Mr. Hardy was having little talks with each of them in turn, so Ian had known it was coming. "Well, then," Mr. Hardy had said, closing the door behind Ian and motioning him toward a chair, "what's it to be?" They were in the history classroom. A map of the world hung on the wall behind him, with the British Empire colored pink. A cartoon was pinned up beside the map, gigantic Canadian soldiers looming over a terrified little Hitler, and beside the cartoon was a newspaper headline, yellowed with age, that read, "Success of Operation Provides Jolt for Nazis." Both cartoon and headline referred to the Battle of Dieppe in the Second World War, and Mr. Hardy, who'd had his leg shot off there, had printed a caption for the cartoon in neat black letters that said, "The first casualty of war is truth." His classes knew more about the Battle of Dieppe than they knew about all the other battles in history put together. Mr. Hardy sat down behind his desk and raised his eyebrows at Ian. "Am I right to assume I'm speaking to the next Dr. Christofferson?" He had smiled,
and Ian had felt irritation rising up in him like a wave. "I've decided I'd like to study agriculture," he said. He'd had no idea he was going to say such a thing until the words came out of his mouth, but it was satisfying to see his teacher's reaction.
"Agriculture," Mr. Hardy said slowly, as if he hadn't heard the word before and wasn't too sure what it meant.
"Yes," Ian said. "I'd like to be a farmer." Mr. Hardy picked up a pencil and doodled a little square on the blotter on his desk. He nodded thoughtfully, then he looked across at Ian.
"You've thought seriously about this, have you, Ian?"
"Yes," Ian said.
"Have you discussed it with your father?"
"Yes." Which was a lie. He hadn't discussed it with anyone because he had no intention of becoming a farmer. He had spent enough time with Arthur to know that farming was not an easy option. It was just that he seemed to have become allergic to the question. It felt as if people had been asking him that question twice a day since the day he was born. Though maybe it wasn't so. Maybe he just kept asking it of himself.
"Well," Mr. Hardy said after another pause, "there's an excellent school of agriculture in Guelph. Would you like to apply to that?"
Ian's heart started to thump. Was this it, then? Had he just decided his future in a single spasm of irritation?
"Where is Guelph exactly?" he said, as if that had anything to do with anything.
"Southern Ontario, not far from Toronto."
There was a long silence. The teacher doodled another square. Ian cast about in his mind for a way out. Finally, he said,
"Can I think about it?"
Mr. Hardy nodded.
"I think that would be a good idea."
He looked up and smiled again, and his smile suggested that he knew Ian was bluffing, which irritated Ian so much that he almost decided to become a farmer, after all, out of spite. But here he was, months later, still thinking about it, or, to be accurate, still avoiding thinking about it, and the final exams were upon him. Each year, the teachers implied that the exams you were taking now were the most critical ones you would ever face, and each year, the moment you'd finished, you could see the next lot looming. It was like climbing a mountain. It wasn't until you reached the top that you realized it wasn't the top, it was merely a foothill. To add to it all, for some unaccountable reason, in the past year he had started creating hurdles for himself, mini-peaks within the overall mountain range. He'd be annoyed with himself if he didn't achieve an A. He had no idea why. He envied Pete, who seemed to be less concerned about the future with every passing day. It was math he was studying when his father called him. Math was one subject he'd never worried about. He'd always thought that you could either do it or you couldn't, so there was no point in studying for it. And he'd continued to believe that right up until he'd flipped open the textbook earlier in the evening and seen the chapter on differential equations and integration. He'd understood it fine when they'd studied it in class, but now it looked like Greek. In fact, parts of it were, and the exam was tomorrow. He'd been working for a couple of hours when there was a commotion in the hallway downstairs, loud voices and scuffling. A moment later his father called him from the foot of the stairs in the calm but very definite tone he used when he needed help now, this minute. Ian got up from his desk and went down the stairs fast. There was a trail of blood leading from the side door to his father's office, and when he got inside there was a sizable pool of blood on the floor. The room was crowded with people. His father and Sergeant Moynihan were trying to lift a struggling man onto the examination table, and there was another man standing against the wall. Most of the blood was coming from the first man from a wound in his thigh. Ian stepped forward, grabbed a flailing leg, and helped heave him onto the table. He didn't know the man, but guessed from his accent, not French, but something European, and from the stink of alcohol, that he was a logger. He was swearing in fractured English, and Sergeant Moynihan was swearing back.
"Just shut up, for Christ's sake," he was saying. "You've caused enough trouble for one night. We don't need to listen to you as well." "Bloody bastard!"
the man said, trying to lunge at the man against the wall.
"Stinking bloody bastard!"
He was young, early 20s at most, and strongly built, and Sergeant Moynihan had to lean hard on his shoulders while Ian lay across his legs. The second he was on the table, Ian's father jammed his hand into the man's groin to stop the bleeding. It had been spurting out bright red blood. That spurting, pumping action and bright red blood was bad news, Ian knew. His father tapped the man's chest sharply with his free hand and said, "Listen to me, you got a bad cut here. If you don't let us see to it, you're going to be in real trouble. Do you understand?"
"Bastard!"
the man said, but he did stop thrashing about. His face was very pale, and his forehead was beaded with sweat. A belt was cinched ineffectually around his thigh a couple of inches above the wound, his own belt, evidently. His trousers were sagging down. Below the belt, his trouser leg was soaked with blood. A rag had been wrapped around the wound, but it had slipped down. "I'm going to need you to do this, Ian," his father said. Ian let go of the man's feet. He was quiet now anyway, and stepped up beside his father. Dr. Christofferson grabbed his hand and wedged it in hard to the groin. "Keep it there," he said. To the policeman, he said, "How long has it been since you got to him, Jerry?"
15 minutes, maybe. Had to get the both of them into the car."
"And how much blood was there when you arrived?"
"Fair-sized pool. All of them crowded around outside Ben's. No one doing a damn thing to stop it."
Dr. Christofferson was slicing the man's trousers with a pair of scissors upward from the tourniquet.
"What you doing?"
the man said, lifting his head and craning to see. Suddenly he seemed terrified.
"What you bloody doing?"
"It's okay," Dr. Christofferson said quietly. "Don't worry." "What's your name?" He was working fast. Ian could feel the urgency in his movements. He slit the man's trousers right up to the waist, then slit the underwear too. "Right," he said to Ian. His voice was calm and quiet. If you didn't know him, you wouldn't realize there was any cause for concern. "Now we can see what we're doing. Your job is to shut off the femoral artery. I'll show you exactly where in a sec. Don't let up the pressure with your hand just yet." Ian nodded. His own heart was pumping hard. He'd seen plenty of blood before, but never like this. He was standing in blood. There was a thick pool of it spreading out under the table. His father pulled the man's trousers aside as far as Ian's hand would permit, exposing the groin. The man's genitals flopped out, and the doctor tucked them back under the torn trousers. The man didn't seem to notice. He'd stopped resisting in any way. "What's your name?" Dr. Christofferson asked again, sparing a moment to glance at his face. But he didn't respond. It was scary how fast he'd gone from fighting to apathy. He lay still now, staring vaguely at the ceiling. His mouth was open, and he was panting short, shallow breaths. "Okay," Dr. Christofferson said to Ian. "Now I want you to press right there. Use both thumbs. Press hard." Ian pressed down, trying to identify the artery with his thumbs. He found it, felt the man's pulse throbbing, and flattened it hard against the bone beneath. The man's genitals spilled out again, and he couldn't avoid touching them with the edge of his hand. "Sorry," he said, but the man didn't care. His father was watching to see that the bleeding had stopped. "Good," he said. "You got it. Keep it like that." He pulled on the belt to undo the tourniquet, and the man gave a high, thin scream and arched his back. Ian struggled to keep his thumbs in position. "Okay," his father said gently. "It'll only take a minute. Just hold on." He removed the belt and started cutting off the bandages around the man's leg. "Any idea what made the cut?" he asked Sergeant Moynihan. "Knife? Broken glass?"
"Knife. Both of them had knives."
Ian glanced over at the man against the wall. He hadn't even looked at him before, but now he saw that it was Jim Lightfoot, who lived near Pete on the reserve, and who had been a year ahead of them in school until he left to work at the lumberyard. He was bleeding from a cut running down the side of his face, from forehead to chin. He was moving his head in an odd way, raising his shoulder to wipe the blood away instead of wiping it off with his hand, and Ian realized, with a shock, that his hands were tied behind his back.
Jim felt his glance and looked at him, and Ian gave him a swift, embarrassed nod. Jim looked away. Dr. Christophus was peering at the wound in the other man's leg.
"We could be in luck," he said. "It's not quite severed. I think we can deal with that. You're going to have to play anesthetist, Jerry, but we have to get some blood into him first."
He glanced at Jim Lightfoot.
"You know your blood group, Jim?"
Jim looked at him, but didn't reply.
Dr. Christofferson went over to his desk and opened one of the file cabinets in which he had the medical records, including the blood group of every person in Struan and the surrounding area, plus a list of those who would act as donors in an emergency.
He flicked through it for Jim's card, looked at it, and shook his head.
"Group B," he said. "It's going to be you, Jerry."
He got two sawhorses from over by the wall and set them beside the examination table.
"Jesus," Sergeant Moynihan said. "It's always me. Why not Ian?"
"Ian is Group B, too, and we don't know this man's group and your Group O, which is the best bet. We've been through all of this before. Help me set up the table, please."
"How about your volunteers?" Jerry said. "Get one of them."
"We don't have time," Dr. Christofferson said. "Help me with this, please."
"I hate those bloody needles. How many bastards have I given my own blood to over the years?"
"Jerry, we're in a hurry." Still grumbling, the policeman helped him put the old door they used as a transfusion table onto the sawhorses. "Roll up your sleeve and lie down, please." Ian's father was already back at his cabinet, taking things out of the drawer, moving fast. Ian felt the man give a kind of shudder, then draw in his breath and let it out in a long, slow exhalation. He was still staring at the ceiling. Ian waited for him to take another breath. His father was preparing the transfusion tubing and had his back to them. Sergeant Moynihan was rolling up his sleeve. Ian watched the man's face. "Breathe," he thought. The man stared at the ceiling, unblinking. Ian said, "Dad?" His own heart was suddenly thumping so hard he could hardly breathe himself. His father looked around.